the contract provides, it's a contract, it's a receivable. What are you going to do with it? Is the buyer going to take it? In which case, how much is the buyer going to pay for it? And is there going to be a payout, or is there going to be a cash out of the amount of the receivable? If the seller is going to retain it, the issues become, what are the seller's remedies? The buyer certainly doesn't want the seller to have the, the buyer doesn't want the seller to have a remedy about either suing the tenant, who is now the buyer's tenant, or at worst case, terminating a lease of what is now the buyer's tenant and a cash flow for which the buyer just paid. So these issues need to be talked about and worked out between buyer and seller, and not just ignore the fact that there is this agreement and the receivable out there. Other issues, it seems to me, arise as a result of the application of the supreme law being Murphy's Law. Being that anything that can go wrong likely will go wrong. And to me, it seems like in this case, that means look at your warranties and representations to make sure that it fits with the fact of an outstanding deferral agreement, an outstanding rent receivable. And then the estoppel letters, who's writing the estoppel letters? Does the person writing the estoppel letters have knowledge of the deferrals, and are those going to be properly reflected? And then in the what are called the standard terms of a purchase and sale contract, do the closing prorations properly address the fact of the outstanding receivable and contract? And the post-closing provisions normally would not deal with such a thing. So all of these are issues that, while they may not rise to the constitutional issues of whether eviction programs are constitutional, or things that do affect the practice. Robert had some additional thoughts.
Yeah, I have. I'm going to do a slight detour here that, that addresses kind of a statute of frauds issue that's come up in my practice in the last few years. I want to start out, you know, thanks to the Winstead folks for raising statute of frauds again. I haven't heard it in a while in mortgage lending. As you know, it was originally adopted in 1677 when Professor Ryder here was but a mere toddler. He says he only has a vague recollection of the original event, but I think he's just being modest. Regardless, you can see from our recent case updates, the statute of frauds is still very much alive. So when we started working on this project, I mentioned to Brian that I was seeing a lot of documents that had pretty glaringly deficient property descriptions in them. And I thought we probably ought to just raise this again as a topic for people to focus on. And remember, if you don't have a legally sufficient property description, you'll have a contract. And so I'm going to encourage everybody to refocus on this and spread the word to the people that you practice with that the property description matters. And, you know, a Google Map's not going to cut it. You know, it's great for an LOI, but it doesn't get you there, you know, for your contract. And I've seen Google Maps on $10 million plus contracts. I've seen leases. I've seen ground leases with proper, with street addresses for property descriptions. I've seen Google Maps with pins dropped on them for buildings on industrial leases, just a bunch of stuff that, frankly, in my view, is not even close. So the whole point of this little exercise was to make sure that everybody really stops and thinks about this and doesn't just go run through it. Oh, we've got a property description and move on. Really focus on it to make sure it really does fully and completely describe the property you're trying to deal with. Otherwise, you may not have the deal you think you do, and your client could end up being very unhappy as a result of that.
No doubt. The next item on the list here is the CFPB debt collector rule. This came in into effect in April as an emergency final rule. It affects or it impacts residential leases and mostly lease evictions, because what it does is it demands that in connection with an eviction, the debt collector, which can be the lawyer, inform the renter of their rights under any federal, state, or local eviction moratorium. Now, that's a moving target. The rule says that the CFPB was going to do a standard form, but I don't know. I haven't seen one come down the pike. This is not an area of practice that I specialize in, so I might have not seen it come down. But It seems to me it'd be very difficult to create a standardized form when different cities and different states have different programs about these evictions. There's a holdover from, there's an issue about holdovers of federal agencies. This is something that friends of mine in the Washington, D.C. area who do a lot of leasing to federal agencies have alerted me to and have worried about. And I think the tip here for you guys and girls for the Texas practice is that leases with federal agencies are not normal leases in the sense that you do not have an eviction remedy if the tenant does not move out at the end of the lease or the tenant does not sign a lease extension and just holds over. What do you do? And the answer is that under the Contract Disputes Act, federal statute, you have to make a claim on the agency's contracting officer. And if you don't like that, and that's going to be money. That it is not going to be move out unless the agency decides on its own that it wants to move out. The contracting officer will process your claim and give you some money. Usually a continuation of the rent is what I'm told. But you do not have an eviction remedy. And if you don't like the contracting officer's actions, all you can do is either file an administrative claim within the agency or go to the Court of Federal Claims. At some point, this might become a taking because you're dealing with a federal agency that's in your property physically. But that's not going to get you anything except money either. So, and with the additional court costs. So there is a